Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Omfer podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about emerging trends and infrastructure. This is Kat Sita from OMFIP, and today we talk to Richard Threlfall, Global Head of Infrastructure for KPMG, and Imad Fakhouri, Global Director of the Infrastructure Finance, PPPs, and Guarantees Global Practice of the World Bank. Thank you both for joining us today, and welcome to the OMFIP podcast. Let's start off with your thoughts on how infrastructure planning has changed over the last decade, and more recently, now that we're in a pandemic and social distancing has changed the way that we move, the way that we interact. How has that all changed the way we think about infrastructure development and planning? Maybe Richard, we can start off with you.
Kat, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be with you and with Imad again. So the story of the last decade, and I would argue the story of the decade ahead, is around the role of technology and data in all things infrastructure. And that's as true of infrastructure planning as it is of all other parts of what's happening in infrastructure generally. What we have seen over the course of the last few years is the ability to really bring what I call sort of big data analytic techniques to planning decisions for infrastructure. And we're seeing this, for example, in things like the development of digital twins, of which perhaps the most famous is, of course, that which is being promoted in Singapore with the virtual Singapore project. We're seeing it as well, for example, in a piece of work that KPMG did a few years ago for Infrastructure Victoria, where we were looking at what the future where vehicles are zero emission and connected and autonomous, what would that mean for the infrastructure needs of the state of Victoria in Australia? And the great joy of this is that it's giving us the ability to model and envisage the infrastructure needs of cities and indeed whole countries before we start to commit the billions of dollars that might otherwise be spent on what turned out, in a sense, to be a suboptimal project. So that's been really exciting. I think that trend continues. You've also asked, well, how has this been affected over the last year? And that was a question that we took head on in the very first one of our global trends in infrastructure when we published that report in January of this year. And we said, well, that one of the things that's happened is clearly the uncertainty that is facing the whole world in terms of things like how quickly will individuals want to get back into mass transit systems and buses and so on, is creating a real challenge for infrastructure planning. And it's forcing infrastructure planners to think much harder about the creating more flexible futures, if you like, and alternative uses, and trying to come up with pathways of investments that can be made now, which are no regrets investments, which whatever happens in the world over the next couple of years will turn out to be good ways of having spent that money.
Thanks for your thoughts, Richard. Indeed, I think data is definitely playing a key role in the way that really everything's being planned at the moment, and very true for infrastructure. Imad, how about you? From the perspective of the World Bank, how has thinking evolved in the last decade or so, and how is the pandemic affecting that thinking?
So thank you, Kat. It's a pleasure to be with all of you and with Richard on this podcast. So in the last decades, it's become clear that infrastructure is not just about building roads, generating and transmitting power, or laying down telecom cables. It's about connecting people to better lives through access to opportunities such as jobs and education, saving lives in hospitals with dependable power, and building the digital economy of the future with internet for all. It has also become clear that without decisive action in infrastructure, the world will not be able to tackle the climate crisis. And with the advent and rapid development of digital technology, artificial intelligence, and the Internet of Things, our world is becoming increasingly complex. And this has a direct effect on infrastructure planning. So adapting to these evolutions give us a historic chance to provide better basic services, enhance connectivity, productivity, and efficiency across many infrastructure sectors. And the digital revolution can transform billions of lives through inclusive delivery of resilient infrastructure services, spurring growth, increasing job opportunities, and driving human capital development. And the World Bank has been truly at the forefront of pushing for these transformations. So we wanna, and we have been, helping countries ensure that their infrastructure investment, whether public or by private means, supports low carbon pathways and strengthens resilience to climate change and the other kinds of shocks like the COVID-19 pandemic. We can also help countries optimize private sector infrastructure solutions that are localized, sustainable, and resilient, and that are also informed by best practices, good governance, transparency, and fiscal sustainability. We also know that infrastructure spending is going to play an important role as part of the economic stimulus measures, of course, contributing to job creation and supporting economic growth. But at the same time, this needs to be done in a fiscally prudent and sustainable way. So together with the IMF, we have been developing specific tools for governments to help them monitor the fiscal commitments, including those that arise from commitments made with the private sector and PPPs that may result in contingent liabilities. And we see that all of this has become more starkly clear in the past year in the case of digital services as the world deals with COVID-19. We know that digital technologies have been offering opportunities for governments, individuals, and businesses to cope with social distancing, ensure business continuity, and prevent service interruptions. But our concern as the World Bank is very much to ensure that no one is left behind. For example, we want to make sure that children with limited or no access to internet services can still benefit from online education. And also digitization can piggyback on existing infrastructure and optimize its rollout. For example, the World Bank has been supporting to use existing electricity transmission networks or sewer infrastructure so that we roll out internet connectivity. And this shows, for example, how in this planning mode, we can bring together the old infrastructure with the digitization as we deliver it on the ground. So in this fast-moving scenario, governments will need to plan and spend wisely into the future. And part of this process is going to involve developing appropriate prioritization of such investments so we can get the best bang for the buck. And we have developed and rolled out such tools. And there's a need for energy and transport sector planning specifically to use least cost methodologies, taking into account the increasingly broad set of objectives, including environmental sustainability, inclusiveness, access to services for the poor, resilience to natural disasters, and the need for a life cycle cost approach and efficiency. So it's important to remember infrastructure often carries a high price tag. So once built, if poorly planned infrastructure is going to be hard to reverse, and its lifespan is usually more than 50 years. So in this context, and I return to the point of Richard, big data and little data have the potential to inform infrastructure planning investments and service delivery. For instance, on 5G deployment, as it reaches global scale over the next decade, we're already seeing our clients telling us how to leverage 5G in the transport sector. Finally, human behavior, as you asked, Kat, in infrastructure is also going to be key. So we all want good and affordable services. We spend a lot of time with our clients as a World Bank, helping them establish appropriate regulatory frameworks and enabling conditions that can ensure good quality services that are derived from the infrastructure that is built, and that basic services such as water, sanitation, and healthcare is available to all. So financial sustainability of such basic services is critical, and we are helping create solutions that blend public and, where appropriate, private funds, both domestic and international, to make things more affordable, and importance of public consultations. I want to close with that, as behavioral use of services is becoming a key challenge as societies become more vocal and demanding of better quality and more affordable public services.
Thanks, Iman. You touched on a very important point in the conversation around infrastructure, and that's sustainability. I mean, as you said, many built infrastructure lasts for half a century, really, and therefore how green these infrastructure are really matters and how it affects the environment that it's in. So my next question is, are we moving quickly enough in the direction of prioritizing sustainability as part of infrastructure planning? Richard, maybe give us some of your thoughts on that.
No, we're not moving fast enough. And the world, I think, knows, and the world will be held to task at COP26 in November this year for the slow progress towards the targets that the world itself laid down in the Paris Agreement in 2015. But I'm also glad that Imad sort of brought in this angle of the purpose of infrastructure in his last response, because I started by saying, you know, the role of technology and data in infrastructure has been the big theme of the last decade. As we move into this decade, it's the combination of the technology and the sustainability, the two together, that to me actually represents everything that matters and is happening in the infrastructure space. We need to bear in mind that if we home in specifically on the environmental part of ESG, infrastructure in one way or another is responsible for something between 70 and 80% of the world's carbon emissions, which is a shocking proportion. And that's because, of course, of the contribution of energy generation through coal and gas-fired power stations. It's the contribution from vehicles, particularly from petrol and diesel vehicles all over the world. It's the contribution of shipping and aviation. There's also the contribution of the raw materials of infrastructure. The cement alone is responsible for something like 3% of the world's carbon emissions. So the infrastructure sector has a disproportionate responsibility for the mess that the world is in, and it therefore has a disproportionate responsibility for getting the world out of this mess as fast as possible. I'm a great optimist that it is absolutely within our grasp as an infrastructure sector to completely change the picture to a world in which the vast majority of our infrastructure is truly environmentally sustainable and is going to start solving the climate crisis rather than adding to it. And I guess the reason for that optimism is, if we look at what has been achieved, for example, in the energy generating sector in the last 5 years or so, it has been stupendous. And it is partly the story of, exactly as Imad said a moment ago, that the infrastructure industry has started to prioritise investing in renewable energy, so solar farms and offshore wind, for example. But it's also the story of the way in which the technology, the cost of the technology has plummeted. So you can't, on a podcast, I can't show you a graph, but if I could show you a graph, I could show you that over the last 10 years, the cost of generating electricity by offshore wind has plunged by 90%. And I could show you another graph that showed the same for the cost of generation from solar. And I could show you another graph that shows an almost 90% cost in the cost of battery storage over that period. And that's really powerful, because it means from the point of view of the consumer, these renewable infrastructure assets are actually becoming the cheapest option. And indeed, it's now estimated that it's already true that in countries covering about 2/3 of the world's population, renewable energy generation is already cheaper than coal and oil-fired generation. And the next big prize is the transport space, where what I really want to see is us moving very rapidly towards removing all of the gas-powered vehicles, the petrol and diesel-powered vehicles from our streets. And I'm very optimistic because you can see almost every one of the world's automotive manufacturers is now already producing or has said they will bring to the market a pure electric vehicle within the next couple of years. And again, the price point for the consumer within a couple of years will mean it's cheaper to buy an electric vehicle than it is to buy a petrol or diesel vehicle. So that's all good news as well. But it is the topic of the decade, and the infrastructure industry has the biggest role to play in helping save the planet.
Imad, I know that sustainability is something that's very important to the World Bank. Do you agree with Richard's assessment that although there is a little bit of progress, it's not as quick as we would like it to be?
So thank you, Kat. Let me build actually on what Richard had said. So I think we all agree that climate change is the defining challenge of our time, and that infrastructure is a major contributor to carbon emissions. In fact, energy-related emissions account for 3/4 of the global emissions. So I believe that countries today no longer need to be convinced that clean energy is in their national interest, even without taking climate action into account. And this is very much because of the marked and continuous fall in the price of renewable energy, as Richard had pointed out. And there is a growing consensus on the need to take action to make infrastructure greener and more resilient. So if we want to keep the global temperature rise below the 1.5 degrees, then we need to reach zero emissions by 2050. And green infrastructure is essential for that. And while there's been encouraging progress in energy, and we need to continue that, of course, the decarbonization of transport lags far behind, as Richard had said, and has yet to become a major focus for policymakers and development partners. Fortunately, the decarbonization trajectories of both transport and energy are also interconnected. So the electrification of vehicles mean that a greening of the power mix will ultimately lead to cleaner passenger mobility. At the same time, infrastructure investments are essential to improve access to social services, such as education and health, as well as improving supply chains for those services. But let's remember what the gaps that remain are. They're still huge. We have 800 million people that live without electricity. More than 4 billion don't have safe, managed sanitation services. 4 billion don't have internet access. And 840 million live more than 2 kilometers from an all-weather road. So infrastructure quality is essential to maintaining and increasing human capital, whether it's road safety, cleaner transport, safer transport, all protect lives and health. And the COVID-19 recovery is a great opportunity to accelerate the transition to a low carbon economy with green and inclusive energy and transport. And I think we have a great building up towards all the events this year, as Richard had said. So we want to make sure we're going to be mobilizing capital, optimizing technologies, adopting the enabling conditions for private sector investment, because this is going to be crucial for the recovery phase and also for the financing gap that we face to deliver on the SDGs and the climate targets. And across the infrastructure sectors, there is a need for enhanced international cooperation that includes stronger public and private engagement so that we can drive an increase of financial flows to those who are most in need.
Thanks, Imad. We've covered a lot on infrastructure's impact on the climate and the environment and the important role the sector has in saving the planet and improving people's lives. But the pandemic has also shifted focus on the importance of social infrastructure. So thinking about medical facilities, educational facilities, and factoring the pandemic, a lot of this also had to be supported by digital infrastructure. So non-traditional areas of infrastructure, or I should say non-core infrastructure. Is there enough attention being paid on social infrastructure, and is there anything we can do to draw even more attention to it? Richard, go ahead.
Sure, Kat, thank you. So I mean, I guess I've never sort of accepted that infrastructure is bounded around economic infrastructure specifically. To me, infrastructure is the foundation of civilization. And therefore has always covered everything from the economic infrastructure of roads and power and digital connectivity through to the social infrastructure of not just schools and hospitals, but the recreational facilities that we enjoy and so on. But I think the pandemic clearly has focused everybody harder on what constitutes quality of life, and therefore in turn the role of infrastructure in supporting that quality of life. I think what's particularly interesting is there's a piece around the role of digital infrastructure in here. Firstly, just to reflect, what would the last year have been like were we not in a world where we actually already had fantastic digital infrastructure connectivity? It's almost impossible to imagine, isn't it? We might curse the fact that instead of proper human interaction, we hold most of these conversations online, and that our children were not able to go to school but had some teaching remotely. But actually, if we go back only 3 or 4 years before when the pandemic struck, it wouldn't have even been possible to have delivered all the services and the connectivity and the human support that people needed. So in some senses, the timing was extraordinary. The question that the infrastructure community, I think, then carries forward is how do we extract the good out of that? And what does that look like? So it's not just to me a question of the way in which we can build more hospitals in the future and the way in which we can digitally connect those hospitals and share patient records and so on. It's actually a more fundamental question, which is, are there things in our toolkit nowadays which mean that there might actually be a better solution from scratch? In other words, is there more primary care triage that could be done without it being, you know, requiring somebody to trek from a village to a city, which might be really difficult for them, in order to get that help? Are there aspects of education which can be enhanced by digital connectivity? And I say enhanced deliberately because I'm nervous about the idea that we will forgo direct human interaction in things which I think are really important, particularly around the development of children and their education and so on. But nonetheless, it feels to me like there is still a conversation to be had about finding the best of what we have been forced into over the last year and carrying that forward into a better future.
I think there's certainly been a lot of adjustments that needed to be made over the last year. And as you said, it's with education, it's a different environment for kids and their parents, but there will always be a need for, I think, classroom teaching, because interactions are important for development of young children. But nonetheless, we do see a bigger role for digital infrastructure in that area. Imad, how about you? What are your thoughts around social infrastructure and how we are paying more attention to it than before?
So listen, this crisis has shown us that the benefits and opportunities of technology have not been equally distributed. For those without internet access, the economic and social impact of the pandemic has been terrible. Look at the informal economy. There is no such thing as telecommuting. In poor countries, even established businesses often do not have the capacity to pivot to online operations. Even teachers, students, and government officials who need connectivity on and who might have it, but they also lack the digital skills to use these tools effectively. And finally, economies are increasingly relying on fintech to stay afloat, and demand for services such as mobile payments, food deliveries, and e-commerce has and continues to grow exponentially. So in the battle against COVID-19, digital technologies have been front and center. And countries that do not have the infrastructure for widespread broadband are definitely faring worse. And as the crisis wears on, some countries may and probably are going to be left behind. For a start, being able to deploy digital healthcare solutions for detecting COVID-19, we know can save lives. And this is also important to protect countries against future pandemics. In sub-Saharan Africa, as an example, 60% of the population remains out of reach of 4G networks. From a healthcare to education to businesses of all sizes, governments in the private sector must do all they can to connect the unconnected. As this unprecedented crisis has shown, connectivity is a public good. And there's a surge of initiatives underway, hopefully to boost connectivity across the globe. And in countries most affected by COVID-19, regulations are being adjusted to boost internet capacities. And in parallel, we need to boost digital resilience. We are being reactive when we should have been more proactive. A recent report from the Broadband Commission estimates that around $100 billion will be needed to achieve universal access to broadband connectivity in Africa. And this is why the World Bank Group has launched the Digital Economy for Africa initiative, so we can digitally connect every individual, business, and government in Africa by 2030.
So we've covered a lot about the changing needs, changing trends in terms of what we need for the future. But let's now talk about how we're going to fund all this infrastructure. And the pandemic has changed the investment environment somewhat. And what does this then mean for infrastructure? And what are some new financing approaches that maybe we should think about and investors and governments alike should consider? So Richard, maybe we can start with you.
Thanks, Kat. Well, so there's two big things that are going on here. Firstly, the pandemic clearly has completely knocked the bottom out of many of the world's economies. I mean, all economies have taken a massive hit, some because of the huge sums that they have spent trying to offset the impact on their citizens. And many of the emerging markets, of course, have just been decimated by the collapsing global supply chains and tourism and so on. And all of that's been reflected in much of what Imad has shared over the course of some of his last few answers about the divisiveness, if you like, of the pandemic around the world. That impact means that there isn't the buying power held by governments, either in the developing world or the developed world, that there was before we went into the pandemic. And that means the ability to draw down on private investment is greater than ever. The need, both the gap in the infrastructure gap has widened, but also the need to draw that private finance to the table has gone up. The good news is that if we come back to the topic of ESG and sustainability, the financing world has woken up in the last 12 months or so to the idea that investing in sustainable assets is not just a nice thing to do, that comes at some cost in return, but actually is consistent with making a good return. And that has been borne out in many powerful ways over the last year. For example, we can see the way in which stocks that have been invested in renewable energy have performed so strongly over the course of the last 12 months. But generally, it's true across sustainable assets. And it has completely changed the perception of investors. And it means that there is a real willingness and a demand to put money into really sustainable assets. We can see this, for example, in terms of the extraordinary jump in the social bond market that's taken place over the last year, which has basically gone from practically nothing to being a really significant market. We can see it as well in the introduction into infrastructure financings of ratchets that are related to the ESG performance of those assets, for example. Again, I'm really quite optimistic because I think that we have been talking for years about the desirability of bringing significant flows of money from pension funds, infrastructure funds, the large sovereign wealth funds into the infrastructure sector. And I think the conditions to do that are now better than they have been at any point in the last few decades.
Thanks, Richard. How about you, Iman? What are your thoughts on infrastructure investment and how this is changing? What more should we do around that?
So I want to very much build on what Richard has said. So like many other sectors, infrastructure was brought to a near standstill by the pandemic. On the public side, the crisis made governments more fiscally constrained than ever to invest. As they were, and they had to prioritize pandemic response and health and safety nets. On the private side, the private sector investments in developing countries, infrastructure projects dropped by an unprecedented 56% in the first half of 2020, according to our private participation in infrastructure database. So the combination of public and private retreats obviously jeopardizes the COVID recovery and the ability to build back better once the pandemic is under control. And the pandemic also caused concerns about credit quality, borrowers' liquidity, and counterparties' financial robustness, especially in developing countries. And the continued macroeconomic turbulence and the deteriorated economic outlook makes private sponsors and financiers reluctant to invest in infrastructure sector in our client countries, where we require, of course, long-term capital commitments. And we have observed that the greatest impact on infrastructure finance by the private sector has been where there has been demand risk, like airports and toll roads. This has important consequences as we try to re-engage with the private sector, both developers and financiers, as we will have to develop solutions that partly isolate such demand risk until, you know, such a time as the market builds confidence to yet again take on full demand risk. And this implies creating innovative solutions, such as guarantees where the World Bank backstops government obligations under PPPs, for example, and other credit enhancement tools. So the heightened investor risk aversion and the losses by infrastructure operators are going to also create pressures for privatization and asset recycling as a means to monetize assets, given the governments and their SOEs in the utilities tight fiscal constraints. And in this scenario, we must focus on smarter investments. This does not necessarily mean spending more money, but harnessing existing assets, maybe repurposing some of these, and as applicable, use technology to drive efficiencies based on data, as we have said, so we can do more with less, hopefully. And we also need better infrastructure governance. And this is really a critical point, which includes, you know, better planning, as we said, robust project preparation, investment prioritization, screening to decide whether to procure a project publicly or with a private sector support, and strong attention to transparency and fiscal sustainability. And we need to mobilize local pools of private money so we avoid this mismatch between local and hard currency. And this, as you know, is a pervasive problem in infrastructure development in many of our countries. And we need to incentivize local pension funds to be participants in the infrastructure development of their own countries, as infrastructure assets, you know, are ideal to match the long-term liabilities held by pension and institutional investors. But there's good news. Despite the drop in investment, private sector infrastructure commitments in the world's poorest countries was less impacted than others in the first half of 2020 and remains stable. And there are also clear indications that institutional investors would like to be more active in developing country infrastructure. So according to Swiss Re, you know, long-term investors have 80 to 85 trillion that could be used under the right conditions. And to make this happen, we need to work hard with our client governments for robust legal frameworks, for regulatory certainty, for clear environmental, social, and governance standards, as well as resilience indicators. And governments and investors see the significant upside and returns to getting infrastructure right, and there has been substantial progress. What we need now is an acceleration of all these efforts.
I think it's quite clear from this conversation that we are really seeing an alignment between infrastructure development and broader environmental and social inclusion goals, sustainability goals. So perhaps to just close the conversation, you can give me some of your final thoughts on how we can keep moving forward with this approach. What do we need to do more of, and what do we need to get better at? How do we accelerate, as Iman said?
I can see a sort of growing conversation over the last few years around the obsession of governments with GDP growth. It started off in an intellectual debate, but it's starting to move into what I'd call a sort of mainstream discussion with governments. And I think that is the starting point. There's two things we really need to do to cement into the infrastructure sector a proper lens on sustainability. One is for governments to recognise that their stewardship is not simply of economic growth, but is of the quality of life of both the society today and the children and the grandchildren and so on of that society in the future. And that does mean changing the nature of the prioritization of infrastructure, which is something that Imad spoke of right at the beginning of this conversation. And I agree with that. It was really encouraging to see in the Desgupta review that was launched, that was released by the UK government about 5 or 6 weeks ago, which was this really authoritative report on biodiversity and the economics of biodiversity. That report arguing for governments to embrace formally capturing a measure of the natural capital there of their country and seeing it as part of their obligation to manage and protect and enhance that natural capital alongside human capital and economic growth. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is around the infrastructure sector itself being able to properly measure and report on the impact of infrastructure across environmental, social and governance considerations. And we're really in our infancy in terms of doing this. KPMG and Mott MacDonald a year ago supported an initiative with Guggenheim Partners and the WWF, which was looking at the way in which certain established frameworks could give investors some good insight into the way in which different infrastructure projects might score from an ESG perspective, and rather sadly concluded that none of the existing frameworks really did what investors need, because none of them were capable of translating those externality impacts into the sort of financial lens that investors required. So we urgently need to do more work in order to create measurement frameworks that really allow us to make decisions on infrastructure investment, both in the build phase, but also in the maintenance and the operation phase of these assets, which means that we are not just building for economic prosperity, but we're building for quality of life, for now and for the future.
Thanks, Richard. Over to you, Imad, for your final comments.
So listen, there's no question that more, smarter and better infrastructure investments are needed to achieve growth, poverty alleviation and greater sustainability. And in the context of COVID, governments have a unique opportunity to shift the global economy's trajectory towards a more sustainable path by building back better and ensuring a green, resilient, and inclusive recovery. Sustainable infrastructure can not only contribute to economic growth and job creation, but also provide social and environmental benefits. And specifically, as governments prepare their infrastructure investment packages, they could focus on three critical areas: energy, transport, and digital infrastructure. In energy, the most promising investments are those that are going to support cleaner energy while encouraging the transition from fossil fuels. So rural solar electrification is the cleanest and most effective way to reach low-income households in remote areas. So in this time of crisis, solar electrification can help save lives by keeping lights on, accommodating heating and cooling systems, and empowering health facilities in those areas. Renewable energy and battery storage solutions are increasingly able to provide cost-effective energy. And the cost of pursuing these solutions has fallen dramatically, as we said, in recent years, making them attractive options in today's fiscally constrained environments. And there's also enormous untapped potential in energy efficiency at low or even negative cost. In the transport sector, investments should focus on shifting traffic towards cleaner transport modes, such as buses, railways, waterways, and reducing the carbon intensity. So to build back better, this shift can begin immediately with comprehensive tax and subsidy reforms on fuels and vehicles, as well as coordinated planning to improve the availability of low carbon modes. Improving public transport is also critical, as they can help low-income communities access services as well as employment opportunities. And novel initiatives such as regulating the export of used cars, which are on average more polluting and less safe, to developing countries can also make urban areas greener and more livable in developing countries. And finally, strong broadband infrastructure investments are a prerequisite for providing access to digital technologies needed to develop a digital, decarbonized economy that provides opportunities and services to all, from smart grids and smart buildings to automated transport systems and smart supply chains. The potential applications are numerous, as we all see. More than ever, now is the time to firm up energy, transport, and digital infrastructure investments, as they will allow us to overcome today's challenges and prepare for a better tomorrow.
Thank you both. It has been really great speaking to you. We managed to talk about how the infrastructure sector is changing, the bigger role of data, the urgency of thinking about sustainability and digitalization, and of course, the need to make sure that we are drawing investments towards sustainable infrastructure, especially in developing regions. And all of this we've talked about in the context of the great disruption from COVID-19. So thank you once again for having this conversation with me.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.